From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, excessive use of restraints and solitary confinement, suicides and homicides. A new report says conditions at Bridgewater State Hospital are so bad, the state should take the facility into receivership. Also today, Senator Elizabeth Warren takes to the campaign trail with Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump says he'll make America great again. It's right there. No, it's stamped on the front of his goofy hat.
Plus, Beyond the Wall, a new documentary follows the men who've dedicated their lives to helping ex-prisoners get back on their feet and stay out of jail.
16 years ago, thought I would die the way I was running. And when I got to prison, I heard this quote, "If you continue doing what you've always done, you'll continue getting what you've always gotten."
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This weekend, the Boston Globe Spotlight team launched a disturbing, powerful expose into the collapse of comprehensive mental health care in Massachusetts. It's so bad, the state's Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mary Lou Sutters, told the Globe she can't even bring herself to call the state's, quote, patchwork of emergency rooms, group homes, clinics, and therapists a system. Or, as the Globe put it even more forcefully, the Massachusetts mental health system stands, quote, for a state that sets a high standard for itself in human services as a broken covenant with a population with great needs, spawning heartache and tragedy for everyone involved. Well, today, the Disability Law Center is going one step further. In a report not related to the Globe's coverage, the Disability Law Center recommends that Bridgewater State Hospital, the state's prison for people with mental illness, be placed into receivership. Stan Eichner is director of litigation at the Disability Law Center, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so it's a serious recommendation to say that Bridgewater State Hospital should be put into receivership, but why? I mean, your report focuses on what happened with one particular case there.
That's correct. Our report is focused on the death of one individual, Mr. Marino.
Leo Marino, right?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, Mr. Leo Marino. Mm-hmm. But as we say in the report, it epitomizes all the reasons why people with serious mental health issues should not be in a prison. They need to be in a state psychiatric hospital. And that's the problem here.
Okay. So to be clear, Bridgewater State Hospital is run by the Department of Corrections.
That's correct. And it's a hospital in name only, but it's run by the Department of Corrections. And that means that it has an approach, an attitude of punishment, not treatment.
Mm-hmm. So tell us more specifically what happened to Leo Marino that caused you to make this recommendation.
Well, Leo Marino died on April 8th. He ingested toilet paper in his throat, and he ultimately took his own life that way. There are layers and layers that make this shocking and very upsetting. He had done the same thing a day before. There were restrictions to all staff alerting them that he shouldn't get toilet paper because he was a suicide risk. And yet the same thing happened 24 hours later. It was actually the third time that he had attempted to take his own life by toilet paper. And he ingested it and he died as a result. Now, it's important to understand that he was in a part of Bridgewater, which is called the Intensive Treatment Unit, or ITU. That is basically solitary. He was in his own cell. He was, because he was recognized as a suicide list, he had what's called a STO, specially trained observer, right outside the door that was looking at him the whole time. In addition, in his cell is a camera which captures everything that goes on in his cell, and there are one or two correctional officers that watch him 24/7. So all of this transpired. He is doing, over a long period of time, he's receiving toilet paper. The observer is not limiting it. And in fact, he's giving him armfuls seven different times. And he proceeds, they give him the precise means by which he killed himself.
So, Stan, let me ask you. So I hear what you're saying, that the Disability Law Center has found that that Leo Marino was he posed a known risk to himself.
Correct.
That was obviously recognized. He was placed in a form of solitary confinement and under constant observation. So the pieces were in place there for this to not happen, and yet it did. He did end up taking his own life. And in the report that the Disability Law Center put out today, you say that the ultimate responsibility for Marino's death lies with state government, though. So why say that?
We say that because Bridgewater State Hospital has been a problem for the state for decades. It goes back to Titicott Follies decades ago. The Disability Law Center called for Bridgewater to be assigned to the Department of Mental Health in our last report in 2014. There have been studies after studies documenting the fact that this is not a good place for people with serious mental illness to receive treatment. If someone has a serious mental illness, such as Mr. Marino has, then they need to be in a psychiatric hospital, not in a prison.
Well, we reached out to the Massachusetts Department of Correction for their view on this, and they sent us a statement today saying that the DOC will carefully review the report and has conducted its own investigation and taken action as a result of this tragic incident. And then in the statement, they outlined a couple of the steps that they have taken. They say, as a result of Mr. Marino's death, new procedures and protocols have been developed to restrict access to certain items when clinically appropriate. They've even developed a new staff briefing flow sheet to ensure the staff remains aware of a patient's needs and restrictions across staff rotations, and that training was provided by the Department of Mental Health Regional Administrator to specially trained observers in order to clarify their duties and expectations for their role. Does that satisfy what the Disability Law Center would like to see happen?
Absolutely not, and we actually address that in our report. We monitor there on an ongoing basis, so we know both from our monitoring as well as our investigation these actions which have been taken. And it is good that they will do a better job on those very specific things, but that does not change the fundamental point that a prison is not a place to receive adequate mental health services.
Now, in the report, you point out that 48 other states do not have their Department of Corrections in charge of these kinds of mental health facilities for people who need that level of assistance and are in the criminal justice system. In these 48 states, are there Department of Mental Health in charge of those facilities?
Precisely. And what we said in July of 2014 to the prior administration, and what we say now, it's time for Massachusetts to join the rest of the union and not be the outlier. It's only us in Iowa who have this type of facility run by the Department of Corrections. And that's, coming back to your earlier question, that's why we say the responsibility lies with the governor, the legislature, and the carpeted halls of One Ashburton Place. They need to take charge of the situation. They need to take it as seriously as they did the opioid crisis, and they need to protect these vulnerable men, get them out of the prison, and put them in a state hospital.
Now, you want to see Bridgewater State Hospital be fully transferred to the Department of Mental Health and away from the Department of Corrections. The Pioneer Institute put out a study saying that, calling for sort of something in between, more cooperation between DOC and the Department of Mental Health rather than a full transfer. Would that go a long ways to remedying the situation?
As I recall, the Pioneer Institute report calls for a partnership between DOC and DMH.
Right.
What's not pointed out is there already is a partnership between Department of Mental Health and DOC. That is not sufficient. That doesn't change the culture, and it doesn't bring into place the systemic change, which is the only way that we won't be seeing more Mr. Marinos killing themselves at this facility.
Well, Stan Eichner is director of litigation at the Disability Law Center. He's one of the authors of today's report on detailing and calling for the state to take Bridgewater State Hospital into receivership. We'll have a link to that at radioboston.org. Mr. Eichner, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's being called the Supreme Court's most sweeping ruling on abortion since the early 1990s. Today, the court struck down parts of a Texas law that imposed strict requirements on abortion providers. The law required clinics to meet standards for surgical centers and that doctors performing abortions have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. But in a 5-3 ruling, the High Court said those restrictions went too far. And today's decision could have major implications for similar laws in other states. Well, joining us now with more is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Today, she joins us from Aspen, Colorado. Judge Gertner, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. So first of all, I mean, do you agree with the assessment that seems to be making the rounds that this is the biggest abortion-related decision in 15, 20 more years from the High Court?
It really is. I most of the abortion restrictions have been upheld by the court, at least since the mid-90s. Restrictions on what you have to say to a woman who's getting an abortion, restrictions on minors' abortions, on the procedures later on in the pregnancy. This is the first time the court really stopped that trend, which was remarkable. It was almost as if the court was saying this is a bridge too far.
Well, the court specifically looked back at a 1992 case, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey, and they applied a standard that was referred to in that case to the Texas case today, of that of placing an undue, quote, undue burden on women receiving access to an abortion. Explain to us what's going on there.
Well, Casey was a case actually that involved spousal consent and other issues that I was talking about that really go later in the pregnancy. But the court, first of all, in Casey reaffirmed Roe v. Wade, which was extraordinary. And it said that the critical issue is no longer what trimester the pregnancy is in, but really is the fetus viable. And with respect to any regulation, the court had to ask whether or not it was an undue burden, meaning did it pose was its purpose or effect to pose substantial obstacles in the way of a woman's right to get an abortion, and that anything that imposes those kinds of obstacles represented an undue burden.
So the purpose and effect in this case, though, for Texas, is that many of the abortion providers in the state couldn't live up to those restrictions, so just closed down.
Right. And what was interesting about it is the court was saying, so many things about this was interesting. One was the court was saying just because the Texas legislature said this is for women's health doesn't mean a court can't second guess that. And the court is going to go and hold hearings on whether or not it actually does burden the right to choose and whether there is any benefit. And it went through a very careful analysis and said, this is clearly a burden. Numbers of clinics were going to shut down. Numbers were going to have to, it's going to wind up being like 6 or 7 clinics in all of Texas when you combine the two restrictions. And in addition, they concluded there was, in fact, no real benefit to a woman's health. The abortion facilities had a lower rate of complications than the ambulatory care facilities. So there was no net gain to women's health here. But it's really not just, first of all, these are restrictions that are cropping up all around the country. They're called restrictions that are limited to abortion providers, right? So all of a sudden, a host of restrictions for abortion providers. And so this provides a model for those challenges. It's a court saying, we're actually going to look carefully at burdens and benefits here. We're not going to accept what the legislature says and their labels. And that's what's remarkable. And in one sense, it's sort of the first decision in a long time reaffirming pre-viability abortions, saying, this really, pre-viability, this is really not a complex procedure, a low rate of complications, And you really have to go a ways before you can impose these kinds of restrictions on it.
Well, let me ask you what effect this ruling may have on similar laws in other states, because there has been some very significant pushback to the court's 5-3 decision today. Texas Senator John Cornyn said that today's ruling sets a dangerous precedent for states like Texas, which the Constitution makes clear should be free to pass laws that are in the best interests of our citizens. And Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, said the decision erodes states' lawmaking authority to safeguard the health and safety of women and subjects more innocent life to being lost. I mean, is this going to have an automatic effect on laws passed in other states?
There's no automatic effect in the sense that what the court is doing is crediting the findings of a district court that the benefits of these restrictions are non-existent and the burdens are substantial. So any like findings would have to be made nationwide. But on the other hand, it certainly creates a disincentive to a legislature trying to implement something like this. It's not a surprise that the state officials would talk about the state's rights to protect its citizens. Two problems about that. The state doesn't have a right to protect its citizens when doing so violates the U.S. Constitution. And second, the court found this wasn't protection. Mm. This was not for the purpose of maternal health. In fact, maternal health was undermined by these provisions.
But as always, I mean, those opponents of abortion rights would say there is no right to an abortion protected by the Constitution.
Well, if you're going to go all the way back to Roe v. Wade, yes, that I suppose if you challenge Roe v. Wade, that might be true. But the Casey decision from 1992, which was an O'Connor decision, reaffirmed Roe v. Wade. This decision by 5-3 is reaffirming Roe v. Wade. That discussion, it seems to me, is or should be over.
Well, clearly it is not in America, though. I mean, I don't think the discussion of abortion is a long time until that will be over. But let me just ask you, here in Massachusetts, what effect could today's Supreme Court decision have on Massachusetts law?
Well, Massachusetts abortion rights are protected under the state constitution. So if Roe v. Wade were overturned tomorrow, it wouldn't make any difference in Massachusetts at all, because there are protections under the state constitution. As I understand it, there are actually very few, if any, regulations like what Texas passed here. To the credit of our legislature, there's been no effort to essentially undermine the right to choose by the back door. That's what these regulations are, just by the back door. So I don't think it will immediately affect anything. There's legislation now pending in Congress to try to prohibit regulations like this from taking effect anywhere in the country. Who knows where that will go. But in Massachusetts, I don't think it will make a difference, because we're already protected under the state constitution. Mm.
Well, I'm speaking with Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and WBUR's legal analyst about today's major cases decided at the Supreme Court. It's been quite an end of the court term here the past couple of weeks. Judge Gertner, let's talk about another case that the court decided today, and that's the case of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonald. The court ruled on a corruption case involving him. I mean, he had received gifts from a businessman in exchange for providing him with access to government officials and the governor's mansion, and he was prosecuted for that. The court ruled today unanimously that providing access does not constitute an official act under federal statute. So this could have a far-reaching implications for corruption, political corruption cases, could it not?
It surely can. It was actually, it was a unanimous decision, which says something about the strength of the decision. No other opinions in it. They called Governor McDonald's conduct tawdry. There was no question about that. But Chief Justice Roberts made it clear that the one indicia of representative democracy is that constituents can call their elected officials and get access and get meetings and find out who to talk to, et cetera. And that may be even in exchange for campaign contributions and even in exchange for money, as here. The official, when you're giving money to a politician that constitutes bribery, you have to be getting in exchange a specific and focused official act.
Okay.
Let me put it this way. It's, you know, being invited to the governor's mansion for dinner might benefit your business, but unless the governor is calling up the official in charge and saying, you know, give this guy the business, it is not bribery.
But Nancy, let me ask you to narrow it down to a specific and focused act in return, and that then is the entire definition of corruption. Doesn't that leave, honestly, the door open rife exploitation of that? Like, I mean, I can imagine any politician saying, I didn't do X, that specific thing, in return for Y. I mean,
There's no question about that. But what the court is saying, and I actually wrote an amicus brief supporting Governor McDonnell, I might add, what the court is saying is, if you want to do more, you have to be clear about it. In other words, if we want to regulate gifts to politicians in exchange for access and the phone call, then we have to say so. The existing statute talks about official acts in a way that the court said focuses only on, you know, specific official acts in exchange for money. I hate to put it this way, the Lincoln bedroom discussion, right?
Mm.
Not only that, a couple of weeks ago, the Republican Party sent out a missive, which Governor Baker actually rejected, saying that if you make a campaign contribution to Governor Baker, you could get to meet with him, right? If you want to make that illegal, you make it illegal specifically. You don't put it under the cover of a statute that was intended to cover something else. So your comments are exactly on point. But the way to address that through the criminal law is through clear and specific statutes.
Well, that seems like a very tall order, though, because, I mean, the very people who would be subject to that law are the ones that would have to create the law to begin with.
Well, that may be a tall order, but, you know, that's the way we have to do it, because the notion here is that when you leave this up to individual prosecutors to figure out where on the continuum of acts, you know, from I'm giving you money and I'm going to give you the contract to I'm giving you the money, but can you give me a list of people to call? If it's up to a prosecutor to determine where the criminal line is on that continuum, we've given enormous discretion to the prosecutors. If you want to make it clear, the legislature has to make it clear.
Well, Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst. She's also a retired federal judge and a current senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, helping us wrap up a quite eventful term at the United States Supreme Court. Judge Gertner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, well, let's turn now to presidential politics. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren campaigned today with Hillary Clinton in Cincinnati in their first joint appearance on the campaign trail amidst signs reading Girl Power. Warren praised Clinton as a fighter and slammed the presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump.
Hillary Clinton will be the next president of the United States because she knows what it takes to beat a thin-skinned bully who is driven by greed and hate. She knows you beat a bully not by tucking tail and running, but by standing your ground and fighting back.
Well, today's rally comes amidst rampant speculation that Warren is on the short list to be Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate. And to talk about that, we're joined by WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Magna.
Okay, so if you were a betting man, would you think that's a realistic possibility?
So it's a realistic possibility. If I were a betting man, I would bet against it. I mean, here's what we know. The Clinton campaign has been vetting her, but I think it's unlikely, and we can talk about why in a minute. But first, here's the case for Warren. She has incredible star power. She's the darling of progressives. She could really excite those disappointed Sanders supporters. And I talked to Andrew Green. He's the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun, and he published a recent editorial with the title "The Case for Clinton Warren." And reason number one, according to Green, is that Clinton needs to reach these progressives and tap into the kind of political passion that fueled Bernie Sanders' campaign.
And Elizabeth Warren certainly could help do that, in that she hits a lot of the same issues that Senator Sanders does in terms of income inequality, that the system is rigged against regular people. And she has the intellectual and policy chops to really make those cases and has been doing so very well for years.
Okay, so she would help Clinton then shore up the progressive votes. But Elizabeth Warren, Anthony, is also emerging as one of the toughest critics of Donald Trump himself. I mean, that's got to be encouraging to people who want her, see her as the running mate.
Yeah, and as evidenced by that clip you played at the top of this, and this is a role that she really seems to relish. And Andrew Green, the editorial page director at The Sun, said that she's turned into an exquisite attack dog against Donald Trump. And today in Cincinnati, she was at it again. She criticized Trump for example, for cheering the British Brexit vote, which she calls a crisis that she says is sucking tens of millions of dollars out of everyone's retirement accounts. Here's a bit of what she said.
What kind of a man roots for people to lose their jobs, to lose their homes, to lose their life savings? I'll tell you what kind of a man. A small, insecure money grubber who fights for no one but himself.
So, as I said, this is a role that she really seems to enjoy. And as you know, she's been engaging with Trump on Twitter, calling him a bully. Trump calls her goofy, calls her Pocahontas, which is this reference to the controversy surrounding her claims of Native American heritage. Today, the Trump campaign put out a statement calling her a traitor and a turncoat to the supporters of Bernie Sanders. And here's Trump earlier this month in Richmond, Virginia, going after Elizabeth Warren.
Pocahontas, I'm doing such a disservice to Pocahontas. It's so unfair to Pocahontas. But this Elizabeth Warren, I call her goofy, Elizabeth Warren, she's one of the worst senators in the entire United States Senate. And I hope she's going to be chosen by Hillary. Oh, would that be great? I would love it.
Pocahontas, insecure money grubber. I mean, it would be funny if it weren't actually...
Right, if the stakes weren't so high.
If it wasn't the White House that we were thinking about here. But Anthony, what about the idea, and this is a longstanding idea, that a Veep should represent some kind of diversity on the ticket, geographic, ethnic? Clinton Warren ticket wouldn't do any of that.
No, right. You'd have two Northeastern liberals, and that's true. And that's one of the reasons why I think Clinton, in the end, won't pick Warren. Clinton is fairly cautious. There's a lot of talk about someone like Julian Castro, the young Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. He's a rising Latino political star from Texas, so he would have that geographic balance, that ethnic balance, and that effort to use the VP slot to attract Latino voters. On the other hand, this is such an unusual year, and advocates of a Clinton-Warren ticket say it would really shake things up and would be a bold move in a year that demands boldness. So the Baltimore Sun editorialized in favor of that. And here's our former congressman, Barney Frank, saying something similar.
For Hillary Clinton to do something which would be very unconventional, a two-woman ticket, whereas in the past that might have been a problem, I think would benefit her. It would help shadow this inaccurate stereotype that she's too timid.
Okay, but Anthony, I mean, you've said it, that you don't think that this is going to happen.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, a couple of reasons. As I mentioned, Clinton is cautious, and while it makes sense for these two to campaign together, because they can really come together and focus on Donald Trump, the two haven't always been that close. Don't forget that Warren remained neutral for most of the bruising primary fight against Bernie Sanders. She only finally endorsed Clinton at the very end of the primary process. She's also been critical of Clinton. She wrote back in 2003 in one of her books that made reference to Clinton's cozy connections with Wall Street.
Yep.
She's also been a tough critic of Bill Clinton's policies that contributed to the deregulation of Wall Street and the financial collapse of 2008. So there is this feeling that Clinton and Warren represent very sort of different wings, or if Clinton is in the center, Warren is on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But here's a big but, because we talk a lot about whether Clinton wants Warren as VP, but maybe one of the big questions is whether Warren wants to be vice president.
Yeah.
And people like Susan Tracy, who we have on the show a lot, she's a former Massachusetts state representative and a Clinton supporter, says she hopes Warren stays out of this, that she's much better off, more powerful, staying in the Senate.
You know, she's really taken on the torch from Ted Kennedy. She has so much power and so much influence and such an important role to play in progressive politics. And quite honestly, I think that would be lost as a vice president.
Anthony, I think you are bringing up an absolutely essential part of this question, right? Yeah. About, like, what do you have to gain and what do you have to lose if you're Elizabeth Warren to be the VP pick? So what if it happened? Who's benefiting most from even just them appearing together in Cincinnati today?
Well, I think they both benefit in a big way. What it allows Hillary Clinton to do is say, hey, look at me. I'm considering the darling of the progressives, Bernie Sanders folks. Pay attention to this. What it does for Elizabeth Warren, she has this very high profile. It ups that profile even higher. And let's say Hillary Clinton does win. She can call in a chip later with President Clinton. So I think it helps them both in a big way right now.
And as you said, anything can happen in this election cycle. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure, as always.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
16 years ago, thought I would die the way I was running. And when I got to prison, I heard this quote: if you continue doing what you've always done, you'll continue getting what you've always gotten.
Well, this is Luis Diaz, and that is his mantra, one that he repeats over and over to inmates he works with in Middlesex County. See, Diaz has been there. He's a former drug dealer and ex-convict himself. But for years now, he's dedicated himself to helping other former prisoners re-enter society. That journey is documented in the film Beyond the Wall. For 4 years, filmmakers followed Louis and the formerly incarcerated men he works with. Most of them are struggling with addiction and have cycled through the prison system many times. And the film portrays the powerful emotional, financial, and even spiritual challenges they face as they try to stay out of jail. We spoke with Luis Diaz a little earlier today, along with the director of the film, Jenny Phillips, and we started with why Jenny wanted to make this film.
I became interested in making this film after many years of working inside prisons as a volunteer, teaching programs with people who were often very highly motivated and committed. They worked very hard. They were very eager to make it outside the wall, excited about returning to the community, and yet I knew and they knew because of the statistics that they would probably be coming back in again. And in the film, we're looking at the jail population, which is a huge revolving door of people coming and going. And I think it's 9 million people are released from jails every year in the United States. And 75% of them have a history of substance abuse. 95% of those will pick up drugs again. 2/3 will recidivate and be back in prison within 3 years. So I became very interested in how this could possibly be. And I had already made a film about a treatment program inside a maximum security prison in Alabama. But I became interested in what happens when people leave prison. So I went to the sheriff, Peter Katujan, a superintendent, Sean McAdam, and asked them whether or not we could have access inside and follow people as they went back out into the community. And that began 4 years of filming people inside and outside the wall of Bill Ricca House of Correction. It was mostly filmed in the streets of Lowell and Lawrence.
Yeah. I mean, that's the heart and soul of the film is this question that you were asking about. Basically, the odds are really stacked against the formerly incarcerated when they're released, and so many end up back in the system, or with even worse outcomes than that, if you can imagine that. And the efforts that people like you, Louis, are putting forth to try and help people stay away from getting locked up again. And it's something that you actually know about personally, right? So can you just tell me your story a little bit and how you came to this work?
Yeah, so I got interested in the in this type of work because I'm a recovering drug addict, ex-convict myself. And I basically had people when I got out that I got connected with and helped me and walked me through this process. When I was incarcerated, I seen and heard from the guys and personally I experienced it myself, like the struggles that returning citizens face and go through. So once I got clean and got connected with the right people and started taking some trainings and going to school, I was given an opportunity to work in the field of human services as a substance abuse counselor, and that basically was kind of like the beginning. And then I ended up opening an outreach center in the city of Haverhill, then moved it to Lawrence, and basically have been doing this for years. I'd say probably close to on and off, probably like 20 years, mm-hmm. Just reaching out to men, helping them, adjust back into society, because I know the struggle firsthand, because I lived it. It was very difficult for me at first.
Well, Jenny, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the men that we get to know. How did you choose them, and also convince them to let you document their stories?
It's always so, it seems to me, so easy to get people to go on camera. I'm always surprised. I don't think anybody ever hesitated, but of course you've got to build trust. And I think having Louis as our guide enabled people to trust us. I would say in terms of Ray, he's a very interesting guy. He's in his early 40s. He's lived a lifetime of drugs and crime. He's never had a job before in his life. And there's a scene in the film which is kind of riveting, where Louis and Billy and Julio go over to see how Ray's doing, and he happens to be in crisis. It's a hot summer night, and he has done some terrible, terrible things that day. And he's weeping, and he wants a bed somewhere.
Well, we actually have a clip where, Louis, you're talking to Ray, and he's really hit bottom, and he tells you about why he's finally going to go into a program. And he explains that it happened, the decision, he made the decision after something that happened when he tried to initially help someone who was drunk. He tried to help this person get home, and then he says what happened next.
Brought him inside the house, drunk and all. And he was like, oh, I'm going to hook you with a couple of dollars. That was fine. I was about to leave. But when he pulled out that knot, the disease kicked in. And I was broke. And I was starting to get sick. And that's it. It just took over me. It just told me, yo, hit him. And I just kept hitting him and hitting him and hitting him.
Louis, can you tell me about that moment? Like, how do you handle that when someone's just that broken down?
Yeah, I mean, he was really hurting, and Ray, somebody that I had reached out to many, many times, had gotten him into a bunch of different detox before, and you know, this is when we had just came into the picture to help him. So,
yeah. You talk a lot in the documentary when you're working with these gentlemen about having to be honest with themselves, right? And confront the challenges of not only letting go of their past lives, but how to build a new life. And there's a scene that I want to play where Brian Diddy Nolette talks to you about one of the biggest challenges. I think he really accurately says he faces as soon as he got out. And he's someone who'd been incarcerated, 17 times in 14 yeah. years? So it's almost as if he'd known nothing else since he was, 16 years old, yeah. something like that? Yeah. And so here he is. He's sharing with you what he thinks is one of the biggest challenges.
It's hard. You got to get out and get back to what you knew and then change from that point. You got to reestablish yourself. And that's why you always resort back to drugs. The stress, the tension gets too high. It's like, damn, man. I'll do the wrong thing if I feel good about it. When I'm not getting high, I don't feel good about doing it. I have a conscience problem.
He was one of the brightest, most engaging, hilariously funny, endearing young men that I've met in a long time. And he could have been saved, but yet he was a marked man in so many ways. He'd committed so many crimes in the Lowell area. He'd made a reputation for himself, and he enjoyed it. And you can see in the film how much he enjoys that reputation, but he knows it can't work for him much longer. He's kind of aging out of it. He's marked by tattoos all over his body, all over his face, all over his head. How is he going to show up for a job? And he talks about that. He's really a wonderful character in the film, and there's a very Shakespearean-like drama toward the end of the film where he's gone back into the streets again. It's very powerful.
Yeah. Now I don't want to give away the stories of all these gentlemen, but with Diddy, I do have to ask, because you said he could have been saved. Can we talk about what happened to him?
Mm-hmm. So yes, he you know, he ends up dying in the film. He was someone that, you know,
A fentanyl overdose.
A fentanyl overdose. And he just started, so he had a history of drinking and smoking marijuana and had just started abusing the painkillers. So from the painkillers, he went on to heroin. And he bought a bag of heroin that had fentanyl, and that's what basically did him in.
There's a moment in the film where Diddy's really sort of on that downward spiral, and you catch up with him, and he says he's been back on the streets,
yeah.
He was shooting up, and you ask him like, why didn't you reach out to me? Because you know I'm there, right?
Yeah.
And he comes back to you, and he says he didn't want to go to your office, he didn't want to be seen with the other men who come see you. And then he said something which I was really curious about. He just said, those guys are all okay being a son.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be a son. What was he trying to get at there?
Well, what he was trying to say is because, like all the characters in the film, these are guys that I've walked through the process, and these are guys that would always, you know, look for me and call me, and I'd help them. He, you know, he felt like... he didn't want to be one of those guys that became like one of my sons or one of the guys that I mentored. He did on numerous occasions, and you don't see that in the film, speak with me about his using, but he was kind of like in denial. Like he never confessed to me that he was an IV drug user, that he started injecting heroin. When I approached him and confronted him one day, he totally denied it and said, no, all I'm doing is I'm doing pills. But the word on the street was that he was... injecting drugs. So he was in denial and didn't want to go by this agency that I worked for, the Lowell House Addiction Recovery Services Program, because he just didn't want to be seen mm-hmm. as somebody that's seeking help, that's really strung out and that's in desperate need of help. He didn't want nobody to see that.
Yeah, there's a gladiator mentality. It's a manhood thing. And I think it's true on the streets too. But I think it gets really ramped up when you get incarcerated. And so you're supposed to be strong, you're supposed to be independent, you're not supposed to have any emotions. And yet when you see Diddy on the screen, he's weeping. He's talks about taking off his armor. I also want to make the point that when you look at these men, and the large majority of people who have been incarcerated, there's trauma there.
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking with Jenny Phillips and Louis Diaz about the new documentary, Beyond the Wall. And there's a scene that I'd like to play from the film, it features Jesus Ruiz. And you were talking about trauma the trauma that often these how people are exposed to it very, very young in life, and it tends to sort of follow them. And I just think there's a scene that's really... underscores that, where he walks you through a cemetery and points out all the names that he knows very, very well there. So let's listen.
This is Charlisa Ruiz. That's my daughter. She died of SIDS. It's Miguel Baez, my wife's uncle. He died of AIDS. This is Charles McCullough, my brother-in-law. He got killed by a kid I beat up for him because he couldn't fight. The kid seen him the next day, stabbed him 8 times and killed him. I try to just stay focused for my kids, you know? I lost one kid. I go back to jail, I'm gonna lose the rest, you know? And I don't want that, man. But it's like, this life, doing the right thing, working hard for practically nothing, you know? And it's not fun for me, you know?
I think Jesus says so much in that scene. He's saying, look, here's where I've come from, and here's where I'm trying to get to, but it's hard. And he also mentions in another part of the film that, like, you know, he's trying to stay on the straight and narrow, work at his job, look after his kids, be part of his family, but that he's working for almost nothing, and he could make, you know, the equivalent of 2 paychecks, you know, doing what he did back out on the street just in a couple of hours. And there's that constant pressure of not having financial stability or societal support, which is really bears down on everyone featured in this film, Louis. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you tell me about how they handle that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult for most of these men, and you know, when you see their their backgrounds. Most of them come from dysfunctional families that some of the parents have been drug addicts and incarcerated themselves. There's a scene in the film that the first time I watched it, because I wasn't there when they were filming, really got me, was when Jesus mentions his father, and his father having molested his sister. And then he also mentions the mother being a drug addict. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't... they weren't in his life. A lot of trauma with these guys.
I'm also wondering how you try to get the message across that it's worth the really, really hard work to do what they can to stay in the jobs that they get when they're lucky enough to get a job. Because I'm thinking, you know, Diddy tells you at one point in time in the film, like, he can't get food stamps because he doesn't have a stable address. His disability benefits have run out. And so they advise him, like, sleep in a shelter so you have at least an address for a couple nights so we can get you something. So it seems like there's this lack of institutional supports. And then when they're lucky enough to get a job, because, you know, with a Corey in Massachusetts, sometimes it's pretty hard to get a job. I keep thinking of what Jesus said at one point in the film, where it's for almost no money, and if you're trying to make ends meet for your family, the lure of going back to what you did before, which might have gotten you incarcerated, you know, dealing, has got to be strong. How do you tell them, like, don't try to resist that lure?
Yeah, I think with mentoring these men, I'm always it's like motivation, trying to motivate them all the time, not to look back or get discouraged or lose hope, because things will get better. And, you know, a lot of the times they look at me and it's like, you know, if you did it, I can do it. And you know, and I share a lot of stories. I bring other recovering addicts that are successful and other ex-convicts into their lives and connect them so they can see that, hey, there's other people making it and doing it, because it is very difficult and discouraging for these guys, you know, coming out and not having, you know, a license and not having a place to live, having a criminal history, and then on top of that, having substance abuse issues, and sometimes not having even the insurance to be able to get treatment. It can be very difficult and overwhelming for them. That's why I think it's just so important to have a mentor or somebody walking them through this process, showing them that, you know, you are going to struggle, it is going to get discouraging, it might be difficult, but hang in there, because things will get better eventually.
So there are so many forces which are just revealed very honestly in the film through the stories of everyone that you follow. The effect of drugs and addiction, poverty, incarceration, and how they all work together to make getting back on your feet extraordinarily difficult. I mean, you're out there every day, Louis. I just wonder if there's sometimes you just get frustrated and just feel like you can't push this boulder up the hill anymore.
I was just talking to Jenny about that a few minutes ago on my way up here. I was telling her that sometimes I'm like, you know, am I doing anything? Is it worth continuing? I mean, I help so many people, and then sometimes, you know, you see some that end up returning to jail because of the, like, you know, a quick story. I had a guy a couple nights ago who called me and needed to get into a detox. I wasn't able to get him a bed that evening, and he texted me and said, "Well, I'm going to go out. I'm going to go commit a crime." And the next morning, I get a call that he ended up getting arrested that night, assaulted somebody, and he's back in jail. So I think, you know, if I had gotten him into the detox that night, if there had been a bed, he probably wouldn't be incarcerated. And this is a person that's been institutionalized. He's in and out, you know, every time he gets out of jail, because he can't find the right programs, he goes back to doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And he's always in jail.
It's a lot for you to take on.
Yeah. I mean, at times, yeah, it can be very difficult and stressful at times.
Jenny, what do you hope people get from seeing this film?
Prisoners are human beings. They're part of us, and we need them. And when they come back into society, we should welcome them and make life possible for them. The other message that I hope, and it was a surprise to me to find it, and when you make a documentary film, you don't plan what you're going to have in the film. You might have an idea, but you have to go where the story goes. And we were led right into the realization that guys like Louis and Billy and Julio, you see Julio struggling still with his own problems, but he's also there for Ray. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a standing army of returning citizens that get their feet on the ground and they're out there and they're ready to help other people. And they're very, very compassionate people because they understand experientially what it's like to suffer on that level. And we're not using them well enough.
Yeah. Well, Louis Diaz is a reentry and outreach specialist at Lowell House. Louis, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Jenny Phillips is the director of the documentary Beyond the Wall, which features the work of Louis Diaz. It's screening tonight in Lowell at the Fusion Theater. It'll also be screening elsewhere later this summer. We'll have information about all of those screenings at radioboston.org. Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you. A great pleasure to be with you.
And this thought, if you or a family member have been through this and struggled with the challenges of reentry, let us know what it was like. Tell us your story at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.